Recording in progress. Recording in progress.
Didn't do the chant. Can you turn that down, please?
People hear me?
Thumbs up.
Thumbs.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Is that Logitech or USB?
It's my friend's down. All of my friends down. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
There's no switch on.
Oh, it's the Zoom people can't.
But if we can hear them, it'd be a Zoom people issue. Yeah, not their microphone.
Yeah.
Nope.
We need to turn your sound on and tell them we can hear fine.
It's very fine. It's coming.
Guys, we can hear you, right?
Testing.
And tell them we can hear.
Hello?
Can you guys hear us?
Hello? No. How does that try now? We just moved it to this.
Okay. Uncensored, yes.
Oh, is this better?
Yes, okay.
We'll do that.
Sorry about this, folks. No technical issue.
And even 100,000 million of us, having to see and listen to remember and accept. I will not face the truth of the last times.
Well, good morning, everyone here and everyone on Zoom. I can't really see you if I look at the camera, but I hope you can see me and hearing me okay. Well, we are now officially into our practice period, focusing on koans. From the Shoyo Roku. And so without delay, because I've already taken up some time getting being late and also trying to figure out the tech stuff, I'm going to jump in. And I'm going to talk about case 85 in the Shoyo Roku called Judy's One Finger. One Finger Zen. Now, when we read or hear about some of the old Zen stories, many of them include kind of gestures or actions, right? Like waving the teaching stick or the whisk around, or making a fist, or sometimes kicking over the pitcher, a water pitcher, or shouting, the usual theatrics. Gestures, as we know, often speak louder than words. And some of those gestures in the stories include violence. They come from an age of violence. Most of the koans in the major traditions come from the Tang Dynasty, which was from 618 to around 900. Which at the beginning was a really prosperous and culturally rich period in Chinese history. Historians refer to it as the high point of Chinese culture, a golden age of cosmopolitan culture. It was in the world at that time, a great cosmopolitan city with all kinds of peoples from the Middle East, India, the Himalayas, etc., and Southeast Asia, all gathered in the capital, in Chang'an. But during the midpoint of the dynasty, there was an 8-year civil war. So from about 750 to 760 or so, known as the An Lushan Rebellion. And the An Lushan Rebellion was started by a general who wanted power for himself, who after 2 years of gaining a lot of power, he was killed by his own son, who in turn, a few years later, was killed by a trusted ally, who in turn, a few years later, was killed by his son. But during that 8 years, historians estimate there was at least 13 million people killed. At least 13 million. They used to speculate it was like 30 million, but now they've downgraded to just 13. You can imagine, you know, just that was a time, of course, you know, with swords and spears. Terrible time in China at that time. And there were, particularly from that point on, other small skirmishes, small wars throughout the Tang period. And so for the people living there, violence was present in most people's lives. So I speculate that in part because of this, the violence that was present in China at that time, some of the koans include slapping or pulling of noses, boxing of ears, pushing people around. And I think it's quite likely these actions did happen. You know, teachers did box ears of students and pull their noses and that kind of thing. Physical punishment of children, students, and criminals was very common, we know from the historical records, and accepted. In some of the koans, though, there are more violent actions. Perhaps the most famous koan being one where a Zen teacher supposedly cuts the temple cat in half. Now, I must say, this story of cutting the temple cat in half really bothered me, until one teacher pointed out the great unlikelihood that the head of a temple would carry around a great knife or sword in the monastery and or violate the precepts to make a point, but rather would dramatically mime the action. Well, that made sense, because I couldn't figure out how did Nanzan, this great master, suddenly pull out a sword and was able to cut a cat in half. But miming makes total sense. And it does, when I think about it, for a lot of these koans with violence. So the koan I would like to bring up today also uses gesture and includes a story with some violence in it, or more likely, a miming of violence. So the title of this koan, as it's given in the translation by Cleary, is Judy's One Finger. And as I said, it's case 84 in the Book of Serenity, or the Shoyoroku. So I'm going to read the introduction, and then I'll read the case. Here's the introduction. 1,000 awakenings at one hearing, at one understanding, 1,000 follow. The highest people comprehend all with one determination. The middling and the lesser hear much, but disbelieve much. Let's try and bring out the direct, simple point. Here's the case, which is the heart of the koan, right? Whenever Master Zhu Di was asked a question, he would just raise one finger. Now, we don't know which finger. I don't think it was that big of everyone's. And I don't think it was the pinky either. I think it was the answer. At least that's what I'm going to use for my gesture. That's interesting. That's it. That's the whole koan. Judy's story about how he came to awakening and to teach by raising one finger, I think is quite interesting. After Judy became a monk, which we don't know when, but probably a teenager or maybe even just before teenager, he had trained for quite a while in the monastery. He left and he built a small hut on Mount Tiantai, a very famous religious mountain in China, known particularly for having many Buddhist temples around it. And there in his hut, he focused on Zazen practice. Living as a hermit after training in a monastery was a very common practice at the time and is still practiced in China today. Zen practice includes a strong practice of being a hermit, at least in China and also in Korea. But there is another literary source that says Judy's monastery had been closed by the government, a government crackdown on the whole Buddhist establishment at that time. The Confucians had become very close to the emperor, and the Confucians managed to convince the emperor that Buddhism was becoming too powerful. And they encouraged him to drop the monks and nuns out of the temples and make them disrobe. Judy was, by all accounts, a monk who practiced in all earnestness. The story goes, one day, while he was doing Zazen, a visitor came to his hut. The visitor was a nun who was also a very strong Zen practitioner. It was customary when traveling during those days to remove your straw traveling hat, which would keep the sun and rain off your head, those kind of big hats, take that off, and exchange polite greetings with whoever you were visiting. But this nun, whose name was Shirji, or Reality, is the translation, what a name, eh? Did not take off her hat or put down her walking staff. Instead, she circumambulated Judy three times without saying a word and said, if you can speak a word, meaning a word of Zen, if you can speak a word, then I will take off my hat. She obviously was a pretty confident and challenging person, because clearly Shirji was testing Judy to see if what his understanding was. Give me a word of Zen. But sadly, Judy was so surprised that he couldn't speak and he remained mute. The nun asked a second time, and then a third, but poor Judy remained dumbfounded. As she started to leave, Judy finally came to his senses and said, it's getting late. Please stay for the night. One final time, Shirji said, if you can say a word of Zen, I'll stay. Alas, Judy could not say anything. So she left. And Judy was greatly ashamed by his inability to answer. I think we all know this, right? We all know what it's like to fail, to be unable to rise to the occasion out of fear or embarrassment or surprise. And I suppose Judy felt what we may feel in a similar situation. A sense of failure, a sense of despair. Now, clearly, Judy was quite low. He had wanted to respond with something profound, Wouldn't we all want to say something profound? Or at least something true, if not so profound. But he couldn't. And most of us are quite familiar, I'm sure, with Judy's frustration. Frustration, perhaps, at our own apparent shortcomings, our inability to figure this life out, our own stuckness. When reality comes knocking on our door, sometimes our true self is nowhere to be found. We do not want frustration. And yet frustration does arise, yeah? Even in our practice. But it arises, I think, because of our sincere practice. Our vows and deep intention to know and express our life often results in frustration. It's common, very common, at times in our practice to feel getting nowhere fast. The practice of looking deeply and courageously into our lives at some point brings frustration because we have no control, no way to predict when insight or ease will arise. But the good news is that simply being patient with that frustration, holding it with some compassion, is also our practice. When the nun finally left Judy's hut, Judy found himself, as I said, in deep disappointment. That night, he had a dream of a local mountain deity who spoke to him, saying, clearly you have thoughts of leaving the hut and finding a teacher, but don't do that. Soon, a bodhisattva will come who will explain the Dharma to you. It's the kind of dream I'd like to have. Now, it's not clear how long Judy waited. Next day, several days, months, years, but one day a Zen teacher named Tianlong knocked on his door. Judy told him about the nun's visit and his own inability to utter one word of Zen. Judy then pleaded with Tianlong, please tell me one word of Zen. Tianlong then silently raised one finger and pointed at Judy. At that moment, Judy's eyes were opened. Judy had practiced, of course, wholeheartedly in a monastery in his hut for years. So I don't think this was like a one-off experience, but rather simply a ripening of his practice. And the finger was probably a pretty powerful finger. Like Judy, we too practice with consistency. We sit wholeheartedly. We sit with confidence. Or at least we try to most of the time, don't we? Perhaps what was missing for Judy when he was challenged by the nun was just confidence. And Tianlong, without a word, showed him what was always there. In the commentary to this koan, Judy is reported to have said on his deathbed, I have attained Tianlong's one finger Zen and used it all my life without exhausting it. So throughout his life, he was able to let it serve as his own fresh expression of the boundless nature of all things. So what I wondered, what is the meaning of this one finger? I think if it was just a symbol of something, like, you know, oneness or interconnection, interbeing, it would just be that. It would just be a symbol and hardly worth recording. But this story of two Ds is recorded in three of the major koan collections. So what transpired between Zhu Di and Tianlong? How could one finger penetrate so deeply that the story was recorded in all three of the major koan collections? Well, in another koan, there's the story of the Buddha also presenting a similar gesture like Zhu Di. And it goes like this. Once, when the Buddha was on Vulture Peak, he held up a flower before the assembly of monks. All were silent. And then the venerable Kashyapa, one of the principal disciples of Gautama Buddha, broke into a smile. And the Buddha said, I have the all-pervading eye of the true Dharma. It does not rely on letters, and it is transmitted outside of the sutras. Now I hand it on to Venerable Kashyapa. In both koans here, we have the presentation of something immediate, something before we become entangled in our concepts and ideas. Many times when we read the writings of the old teachers, they admonish us, whatever you say, that is not it. I find it interesting that the Book of Serenity presents this koan with just one line. Whenever Master Zhu Di was asked a question, he would just raise one finger. I think I'm going to start doing that myself. Sadly, I can't do that because it's already been done. But I wonder, what can we take from this and what can we carry forward for the rest of our lives about this story, this one finger? Is it just a gimmick or just kind of a cute story? Zhu Di relied on a single finger to bring attention to the presence that never leaves us. In Mahayana Buddhism, we talk about Buddha nature, the vast and boundless nature that includes all things. The 20th century Japanese Zen teacher, Zenkei Shigeyama, in his commentary to this koan, wrote, "Is there anybody who doesn't have a finger? Is there anybody who doesn't have Buddha nature or truth?" So was this what Zhu Di was evoking each time he raised his finger? I was thinking, you know, words really start to get in the way when we try to convey that whatever is happening, whether it's painful or pleasant or sad or joyful, there is something present, something that connects. There is some intimacy there, even when we perhaps fall into feeling we're alone and isolated. I think this is the truth, this intimacy, this connection. This is the truth that Zhu Di opened to and then taught throughout the rest of his life. Many of us all too often feel cut off from others and from the world. And this koan of Zhu Di's is saying there is always something present, moment after moment, the vast and boundless nature that is your full nature, that never leaves you. Can you sense this in Judy's finger? One teacher I heard connected this koan to our Zazen posture, the gesture of being upright. Dogen, in his famous essay, the Fukan Zazengi, spends much of the essay describing the traditional upright posture, right? With the legs, the kind of clothing you should wear, not to eat too much, et cetera, et cetera. He goes on and on and on. But almost nothing to do with what you should do with the monkey mind. Zazen is what happens in your body, not what happens in your mind. Not that there's a difference between the two, though. But the point is that to put your body in Zazen posture, in alignment, is perhaps the equivalent of Judy holding up the finger. Upright, aligned, present. In Zazen, we have the potential to be fully present with nothing missing. I have been practicing Zazen since my 20s. Sometimes I stopped for a while and then started up again. And I started again usually because I realized in some dim way, I'm not very bright. In some dim way, my life was not upright, but floundering. So began Zazen again. In truth, I do not understand why. But my experience has taught me I can rely on Zazen anytime, anywhere, to bring me closer to being upright in my life. Dogen tells us that this posture, and by posture, I don't mean necessarily having your legs in full lotus, et cetera, et cetera. By posture, I mean this uprightness. It helps to sit on a cushion or a bench or a chair. But Dogen tells us this posture is just entering into life itself. Just this is it. Judy raises a finger. I imagine when I think of Judy, somebody would come to him, telling him of an illness, of a personal loss, maybe of a deep sadness, or maybe of recovery, maybe of a wedding, sharing some good news, the birth of a child. And Judy would probably just listen with compassion. Maybe he'd say a few words. But then he'd raise his finger. His reminder, perhaps, of being not separate from whatever is happening. At the beginning of the talk, I said a few words about violence. And in the other two major collections of these koans, the Gateless Gate and the Blue Cliff Record, a violent story is emphasized. And I was thinking, probably emphasized because it's dramatic, big kind of thing. But the Book of Serenity, the Shōryō work, which just has it written in the commentary, almost like a footnote. So anyway, let's turn to that story now. And just remember what I said about miming. So story goes like this. Judy had a young boy as an attendant. And sometimes a visitor would come to visit Judy only to find that he was away or engaged, busy with some tasks. And occasionally, a visitor would ask this young boy attendant the question that was on their mind, or ask what was Judy's teaching, and the young boy would raise his finger, like his teacher, and say nothing, perhaps feeling a little proud of himself. Hey, get that. And Judy, hearing of this, called his young attendant into his room, grabbed his wrist, and then mimed off cutting a finger. The young boy, surprised and shocked by this sudden event, turned and started to run out of the room. And Judy suddenly called out his name. And the boy turned around. And Judy raised one finger. And the boy was awakened, according to the story. So the young attendant copied his teacher's gesture. It was not his own. In some of the commentaries, it said the boy's finger had no life. On one level, this is a warning about imitation. Imitation is, after all, just imitation. It has no juice. So that's one reason I think it's important for us not to overly read Zen literature and get so involved in the story, so that there's no temptation to inflate or copy something that we've read. Imitation, borrowing, just creates more obstacles for us. So let us all be careful. So I imagine the attendant really learned his lesson. But did you also notice the act of compassion? In the midst of the boy's suffering, Judy called out to him. Judy didn't grumble to himself about young boys these days. Judy didn't chortle in satisfaction about teaching a good lesson. Well, taught him a good one. He called out the boy's name and then held up that finger so full of life, that gesture of boundlessness, so that even in that moment of distress, the young boy realized he was not alone, that there was connection and intimacy. The Buddha taught frequently about suffering. And he also taught that it's from our place of suffering that we can begin to awaken. Sometimes in the midst of distress and pain, sometimes, just sometimes, something most precious happens. Maybe you've experienced this. One more point about this koan. Remember when Tianlong, the visiting Zen teacher, raised his finger, he then pointed it at Judy. And I thought, how often we look everywhere for an answer to our most painful questions, but we fail to look at our own heart and soul. Tianlong, in his pointing, illustrates for Judy that no place, no thing, perhaps is other than yourself. As Dogen said, turn the light inwardly and see. Judy did not tell his young boy attendant, to study the precepts more, to do more zazen, although sometimes teachers do that. This was an action that came from the heart. And Zen literature is full of stories about actions that touch the deepest part of who we are. I think it's like the touch of a dearly loved one. We come immediately into the present. Judy's one finger was never exhausted, just like the touch of a loved one is never exhausted. It wasn't exhausted because it wasn't his. It was something vast and boundless. Well, I think I've rattled on quite a while. I have one more quote. I think I'll just cut it so that we can end on time. I don't want to go over time. But I will end with this one line of Dogen, and then I'll close. I'll skip the last part of this quote from Dogen, who talks about Judy. He says, "Now you have met Judy and heard him expound the teaching. However, do not open your mouth and talk with a lengthy tongue about his finger." So I offer my deep apologies to all of you for opening my big mouth and talking with a lengthy tongue. Let us, in our practice, bring forth Judy's finger so that we can bring it forth as we meet our trying times. This finger of unity, this finger of wisdom, of this finger of compassion. Okay, so goodbye to the people on Zoom and Wall Street will then conclude the service. Okay, and pause for going.